were but a paltry few, the handful that remained at court. Grey-faced Lord Giles Rusby was coughing into a square of pink silk. Lady Tender was bracketed by her daughters, Placid Dull Lollies and Acid-Tongued Felissa. Ebonskin Jalabar Zoe was an exile who had no other refuge. Lady Emma Sande, a babe, seated on her wet nurse's lap. The talk was she would soon be wed to one of the Queen's cousins, so the Lannisters might claim her lands. The King was shaded beneath a crimson canopy, one leg thrown negligently over the carved wooden arm of his chair. Princess Marcella and Prince Tommen sat behind him. In the back of the royal box, Sander Clegane stood at guard, his hands resting on his sword belt. The white cloak of the King's Guard was draped over his broad shoulders and fastened with a jewel brooch, the snowy cloth looking somehow unnatural against his brown, rough-spun tunic and studded leather jerkin. "Lady Sansa," the hound announced curtly when he saw her. His voice was as rough as the sound of a saw on wood. The burnt scars in his face and throat made one side of his mouth twitch when he spoke. Princess Marcella nodded a shy greeting at the sound of Sansa's name, but plump little Prince Tommen jumped up eagerly.
"Sansa, did you hear? I'm to ride in a tourney today. Mother said I could."
Tommen was all of eight. He reminded her of her own little brother, Bran. They were of an age. Bran was back at Winterfell, a cripple, yet safe. Sansa would have given anything to be with him. "I fear for the life of your foeman," she told Tommen solemnly.
"His foeman will be stuffed with straw," Joff said as he rose. The King was clad in a gilded breastplate with a roaring lion engraved upon its chest, as if he expected the war to engulf them at any moment. He was 13 today, and tall for his age, with the green eyes and golden hair of the Lannisters.
"Your Grace," she said, dipping in a curtsy. Sir Aerys bowed.
Pray pardon me, Your Grace. I must equip myself for the lists."
Joffrey waved a curt dismissal while he studied Sansa from head to heels.
"I'm pleased you wore my stones."
So the King had decided to play the gallant today. Sansa was relieved. "I thank you for them, and for your tender words. I pray you a lucky name day, Your Grace."
"Sit,"
Joff commanded, gesturing her to the empty seat beside his own.
"Have you heard? The Beggar King is dead."
"Who?" For a moment Sansa was afraid he meant Rob.
"Viserys, the last son of Mad King Aerys, has been going about the Free Cities since before I was born, calling himself a king. Well, Mother says the Dothraki finally crowned him with molten gold."
He laughed.
"That's funny, don't you think? The dragon was their sigil. It's almost as good as if some wolf killed your traitor brother. Maybe I'll feed him to the wolves after I've caught him. Did I tell you? I intend to challenge him to single combat."
"I should like to see that, Your Grace." "More than you know." Sansa kept her tone cool and polite. Yet even so, Joffrey's eyes narrowed as he tried to decide whether she was mocking him. "Will you enter the list today?" she asked quickly. The King frowned.
"My lady mother said it was not fitting, since the tourney is in my honour. Otherwise I would have been champion. Isn't that so, dog?"
The hound's mouth twitched.
"Against this lot? Why not?"
He had been the champion in her father's tourney, Sansa remembered. "Will you joust today, my lord?" she asked him. Clegane's voice was thick with contempt.
"Wouldn't be worth the bother of arming myself. This is a tourney of gnats."
The King laughed.
"My dog has a fierce bark. Perhaps I should command him to fight the day's champion. To the death."
Joffrey was fond of making men fight to the death.
"You'd be one knight the poorer."
The hound had never taken a knight's vows. His brother was a knight, and he hated his brother. A blare of trumpets sounded. The King settled back in his seat and took Sansa's hand.
Once that would have sent her heart to pounding, but that was before he had answered her plea for mercy by presenting her with her father's head. His touch filled her with revulsion now, but she knew better than to show it. She made herself sit very still.
"Sir Meriant Trant of the King's Guard," a herald called.
Sir Meriant entered from the west side of the yard, clad in gleaming white plate, chased with gold, and mounted on a milk-white charger with a flowing grey mane. His cloak streamed behind him like a field of snow. He carried a 12-foot lance.
"Sir Hubba of House Red Wine of the Arbour," the herald sang.
Sir Hubba trotted in from the east, riding a black stallion caparisoned in burgundy and blue. His lance was striped in the same colours, and his shield bore the grape cluster sigil of his house. The Red Wine twins were the Queen's unwilling guests, even as Sansa was. She wondered whose notion it had been for them to ride in Joffrey's tourney. Not their own, she thought. At a signal from the Master of Revels, the combatants couched their lances and put their spurs to their mounts. There were shouts from the watching guardsmen and the lords and ladies in the gallery. The knights came together in the centre of the yard with a great shock of wood and steel. The white lance and the striped one exploded in splinters within a second of each other. Hubba Redwine reeled at the impact, yet somehow managed to keep his seat. Wheeling their horses about at the far end of the lists, the knights tossed down their broken lances and accepted replacements from the squires. Sir Horace Redwine, Sir Hubba's twin, shouted encouragement to his brother. But on their second pass, Sir Meriant swung the point of his lance to strike Sir Hubba in the chest, driving him from the saddle to crash resoundingly to the earth. Sir Horace cursed and ran out to help his battered brother from the field.
"Poorly ridden," declared King Joffrey. "Sir Balon Swan of Stone Elm in a red watch," came the herald's cry.
Wide white wings ornamented Sir Balon's great helm, and black and white swans fought on his shield.
"Morris of House Slint, heir to Lord Janus of Harrenhal." "Look at that up-jumped oaf," Joff hooted, loud enough for half the yard to hear.
Morris, a mere squire, and a new-made squire at that, was having difficulty managing lance and shield. The lance was a knight's weapon, Sansa knew, the Slint's low-born. Lord Janus had been no more than commander of the City Watch before Joffrey had raised him to Harrenhal and the Council. "I hope he falls and shames himself," she thought bitterly. "I hope Sir Balon kills him." When Joffrey proclaimed her father's death, it had been Janus Slint who seized Lord Eddard's severed head by the hair and raised it on high for king and crowd to behold, while Sansa wept and screamed. Morris wore a checkered black and gold cloak over black armour inlaid with gold scrollwork. On his shield was a bloody spear his father had chosen as the sigil of their new-made house. But he did not seem to know what to do with the shield as he urged his horse forward, and Sir Balon's point struck the blazoned square. Morris dropped his lance, fought for balance, and lost. One foot caught in a stirrup as he fell, and the runaway charger dragged the youth to the end of the lists, head bouncing against the ground. Joff hooted derision. Sansa was appalled, wondering if the guards had heard her vengeful prayer. But when they disentangled Morris Slint from his horse, they found him bloodied but alive.
"Tommen, we picked the wrong foe for you," the king told his brother. "The Straw Knight just better than that one."
Next came Sir Horace Redwine's turn. He fared better than his twin, vanquishing an elderly knight whose mount was bedecked with silver griffins against a striped blue and white field. Splendid as he looked, the old man made a poor contest of it. Joffrey curled his lip.
"This is a feeble show." "I warned you," said the hound. "Gnats."
The king was growing bored. It made Sansa anxious. She lowered her eyes and resolved to keep quiet no matter what. When Joffrey Baratheon's mood darkened, any chance word might set off one of his rages.
"Lothar Brune, free rider in the service of Lord Baelish," cried the herald. "Sir Duntus the Red of House Hollard."
The free rider, a small man in dented plate without device, duly appeared at the west end of the yard. But of his opponent there was no sign. Finally, a chestnut stallion trotted into view in a swirl of crimson and scarlet silks. But Sir Dontus was not on it. The knight appeared a moment later, cursing and staggering, clad in breastplate and plumed helm and nothing else. His legs were pale and skinny, and his manhood flopped about obscenely as he chased after his horse. The watchers roared and shouted insults. Catching his horse by the bridle, Sir Dontus tried to mount, but the animal would not stand still, and the knight was so drunk that his bare foot kept missing the stirrup. By then, the crowd was howling with laughter, all but the king. Joffrey had a look in his eyes that Sansa remembered well, the same look he'd had at the great sept of Baelor the day he pronounced death on Lord Eddard Stark. Finally, Sir Dontus the Red gave it up for a bad job, sat down in the dirt, and removed his plumed helm.
"I lose," he shouted. "Fetch me some wine."
The king stood.
"A cask from the cellars. I'll see him drowned in it."
Sansa heard herself gasp.
"No, you can't."
Joffrey turned his head.
"What did you say?"
Sansa could not believe she had spoken. Was she mad? To tell him no, in front of half the court? She hadn't meant to say anything, only Sir Dontus was drunken and silly and useless, but he meant no harm.
"Did you say I can't? Did you?"
"Please," Sansa said, "I only meant it would be ill luck, your grace, to kill a man on your name day."
"You're lying," Joffrey said. "I ought to drown you with him, if you care for him so much."
"I don't care for him, your grace." The words tumbled out desperately. "Drown him or have his head off, only kill him on the morrow, if you like, but please, not today, not on your name day. I couldn't bear for you to have ill luck. Terrible luck, even for kings. The singers all say so."
Joffrey scowled. He knew she was lying. She could see it. He would make her bleed for this.
"The girl speaks truly," the hound rasped. "What a man sows on his name day, he reaps throughout the year."
His voice was flat, as if he did not care a whit whether the king believed him or no. Could it be true? Sansa had not known. It was just something she'd said, desperate to avoid punishment. Unhappy, Joffrey shifted in his seat and flicked his fingers at Sir Dontus.
"Take him away. I'll have him killed on the morrow, the fool."
"He is," Sansa said, "a fool. You're so clever to see it. He's better fitted to be a fool than a knight, isn't he? You ought to dress him in motley and make him clown for you. He doesn't deserve the mercy of a quick death." The king studied her for a moment.
"Perhaps you're not so stupid as Mother says."
He raised his voice.
"Did you hear, my lady, Dontus? From this day on, you're my new fool. You can sleep with Moonboy and dress in motley."
Sir Dontus, sobered by his near brush with death, crawled to his knees.
"Thank you, your grace, and you, my lady, thank you."
As a brace of Lannister guardsmen led him off, the Master of Revels approached the box.
"Your grace," he said, "shall I summon a new challenger for Brune or proceed with the next tilt?" "Neither. These are gnats, not knights. I'd have them all put to death, only it's my name day. The tourney is done. Get them all out of my sight."
The Master of Revels bowed, but Prince Tommen was not so obedient.
"I'm supposed to ride against a straw man. Not today. But I want to ride." "I don't care what you want."
"Mother said I could ride."
"She said," Princess Morello agreed. "Mother said," mocked the king. "Don't be childish."
"'We're children,' Marcella declared haughtily. "'We're supposed to be childish.' The hound laughed.
"'She has you there!'
Joffrey was beaten. "'Very well. Even my brother couldn't tilt any worse than these others. Master, bring out the Quinton. Tommen wants to be a net.'
Tommen gave a shout of joy and ran off to be readied, his chubby little legs pumping hard. "'Luck!' Sansa called to him.
They set up the Quinton at the far end of the lists, while the prince's pony was being saddled.
Tommen's opponent was a child-sized leather warrior stuffed with straw and mounted on a pivot, with a shield in one hand and a padded mace in the other. Someone had fastened a pair of antlers to the knight's head. Joffrey's father, King Robert, had worn antlers on his helm, Sansa remembered. But so did his uncle, Lord Renly, Robert's brother, who had turned traitor and crowned himself king. A pair of squires buckled the prince into his ornate silver and crimson armour. A tall plume of red feathers sprouted from the crest of his helm, and the line of Lannister and crown stag of Baratheon frolicked together on his shield. The squires helped him mount, and Sir Aaron Santagar, the Red Keep's master-at-arms, stepped forward and handed Tommen a blunted silver longsword with a leaf-shaped blade, crafted to fit an eight-year-old hand.
Tommen raised the blade high.
"'Casterly rock!'
he shouted in a high boyish voice as he put his heels into his pony and started across the hard-packed dirt at the Quinton. Lady Tender and Lord Giles started a ragged cheer, and Sansa added her voice to theirs. The king brooded in silence. Tommen got his pony up to a brisk trot, waved his sword vigorously, and spun the knight's shield a solid blow as it went by. The Quinton spun, the padded mace flying around to give the prince a mighty whack in the back of his head.
Tommen spilled from the saddle, his new armour rattling like a bag of old pots as he hit the ground. His sword went flying, his pony cantered away across the bailey, and a great gale of derision went up. King Joffrey laughed longest and loudest of all.
"Oh!"
Princess Marcella cried. She scrambled out of the box and ran to her little brother. Sansa found herself possessed of a queer, giddy courage.
"You ought to go with her," she told the king. "Your brother might be hurt."
Joffrey shrugged.
"What if he is?"
"You should help him up and tell him how well he rode." Sansa could not seem to stop herself.
"He got knocked off his horse and fell in the dirt," the king pointed out. "That's not riding well."
"Look," the hound interrupted. "The boy has courage. He's going to try again."
They were helping Prince Tommen mount his pony.
If only Tommen were the elder instead of Joffrey, Sansa thought. I wouldn't mind marrying Tommen.
The sounds from the gatehouse took them by surprise. Chains rattled as the portcullis was drawn upward, and the great gates opened to the creak of iron hinges.
"Who told them to open the gate?"
Joff demanded. With the troubles in the city, the gates of the Red Keep had been closed for days. A column of riders emerged from beneath the portcullis, with a clink of steel and a clatter of hooves. Clegane stepped close to the king, one hand on the hilt of his longsword. The visitors were dinted and haggard and dusty, yet the standard they carried was the Lion of Lannister, golden on its crimson field. A few wore the red cloaks and mail of Lannister men-at-arms, but more were free riders and sellswords, armoured in oddments and bristling with sharp steel. And there were others, monstrous savages, out of one of old Nan's tales, the scary ones Bran used to love. They were clad in shabby skins and boiled leather, with long hair and fierce beards. Some wore blood-stained bandages over their brows or wrapped round their hands, and others were missing eyes, ears, and fingers. In their midst, riding on a tall red horse, in a strange high saddle that cradled him back and front, was the queen's dwarf brother, Tyrion Lannister, the one they called the Imp. He'd let his beard grow to cover his pushed-in face until it was a bristly tangle of yellow and black hair, coarse as wire. Down his back flowed a shadow-skin cloak, black fur striped with white. He held the reins in his left hand and carried his right arm in a white silk sling, but otherwise looked as grotesque as Sansa remembered from when he had visited Winterfell. With his bulging brow and mismatched eyes, he was still the ugliest man she had ever chanced to look upon. Yet Tommen put his spurs into his pony and galloped headlong across the yard, shouting with glee. One of the savages, a huge, shambling man, so hairy that his face was all but lost beneath his whiskers, scooped the boy out of his saddle, armour and all, and deposited him on the ground beside his uncle. Tommen's breathless laughter echoed off the walls as Tyrion clapped him on the backplate, and Sansa was startled to see that the two were of a height. Myrcella came running after her brother, and the dwarf picked her up by the waist and spun her in a circle, squealing. When he lowered her back to the ground, the little man kissed her lightly on the brow and came waddling across the yard toward Joffrey. Two of his men followed close behind him, a black-haired, black-eyed sellsword who moved like a stalking cat, and a gaunt youth with an empty socket where one eye should have been. Tommen and Myrcella trailed after them. The dwarf went to one knee before the king. "Your Grace." "You," Joffrey said. "Me," the imp agreed, "although a more courteous greeting might be in order for an uncle and an elder." "They said you were dead," the hound said. The little man gave the big one a look. One of his eyes was green, one was black, and both were cool. "I was speaking to the king, not to his cur." "I'm glad you're not dead," said Princess Myrcella. "We share that view, sweet child," Tyrion turned to Sansa. "My lady, I am sorry for your losses. Truly, the gods are cruel." Sansa could not think of a word to say to him. How could he be sorry for her losses? Was he mocking her? It wasn't the guards who'd been cruel. It was Joffrey. "I am sorry for your loss as well, Joffrey," the dwarf said. "What loss?" "Your royal father. A large, fierce man with a black beard. You'll recall him if you try. He was king before you."
"Oh, him. Yes, it was very sad. A boar killed him."
"Is that what they say, Your Grace?"
Joffrey frowned. Sansa felt she ought to say something. What was it that Septa Mordain used to tell her?
"Lady's armour is courtesy."
That was it. She donned her armour and said, "I'm sorry my lady mother took you captive, my lord."
"A great many people are sorry for that," Tyrion replied. "And before I am done, some may be a deal sorrier. Yet I thank you for the sentiment. Joffrey, where might I find your mother?"
"She's with my council," the king answered. "Your brother, Jaime, keeps losing battles."
He gave Sansa an angry look, as if it were her fault.
"He's been taken by the Starks, and we've lost Riverrun, and now her stupid brother is calling himself a king."
The dwarf smiled crookedly.
"All sorts of people are calling themselves kings these days."
Joff did not know what to make of that, though he looked suspicious and out of sorts.
"Yes, well, I'm pleased you're not dead, uncle. Did you bring me a gift for my name day?"
"I did. My wits."
"I'd sooner have Rob Stark's head," Joff said, with a sly glance at Sansa. "Tommen, Myrcella, come."
Sandor Clegane lingered behind a moment.
"I'd guard that tongue of yours, little man," he warned, before he strode off after his liege.
Sansa was left with the dwarf and his monsters. She tried to think of what else she might say.
"You hurt your arm," she managed at last.
"One of your Northmen hit me with a morning star during the battle on the Green Fork. I escaped him by falling off my horse."
His grin turned into something softer as he studied her face.
"Is it grief for your lord father that makes you so sad?"
"My father was a traitor,"
Sansa said at once. And my brother and Lady Mother are traitors as well. That reflex she had learned quickly. I am loyal to my beloved Joffrey. No doubt, as loyal as a deer surrounded by wolves.
Lions, she whispered without thinking.
She glanced about nervously, but there was no one close enough to hear. Lannister reached out and took her hand and gave it a squeeze.
I'm only a little lion, child, and I vow I shall not savage you.
Bowing, he said, But now you must excuse me. I have urgent business with Queen and Council. Sansa watched him walk off, his body swaying heavily from side to side with every step, like something from a grotesquerie.
He speaks more gently than Joffrey, she thought. But the Queen spoke to me gently too. He's still a Lannister, her brother, and Joff's uncle, and no friend.
Once she had loved Prince Joffrey with all her heart, and admired and trusted his mother, the Queen. They had repaid that love and trust with her father's head. Sansa would never make that mistake again.
The Captain of Guards.
The blood oranges are well past ripe,
the prince observed in a weary voice when the captain rolled him onto the terrace. After that, he did not speak again for hours. It was true about the oranges. A few had fallen to burst open on the pale pink marble. The sharp, sweet smell of them filled Hotar's nostrils each time he took a breath. No doubt the prince could smell them too as he sat beneath the trees in the rolling chair Maester Caliot had made for him, with its goose-down cushions and rumbling wheels of ebony and iron. For a long while, the only sounds were the children splashing in the pools and fountains, and once a soft plop as another orange dropped onto the terrace to burst. Then from the far side of the palace, the captain heard the faint drumbeat of boots on marble. Obara. He knew her stride, long-legged, hasty, angry. In the stables by the gates, her horse would be lathered and bloody from her spurs. She always rode stallions and had been heard to boast that she could master any horse in Dorne, and any man as well. The captain could hear other footsteps as well, the quick, soft scuffing of Maester Caliot hurrying to keep up. Obara Sand always walked too fast.
She is chasing after something she can never catch,
the prince had told his daughter once in the captain's hearing. When she appeared beneath the triple arch, Aryo Hota swung his long axe sideways to block the way. The head was on a shaft of mountain ash 6 feet long, so she could not go around. My lady, no father. His voice was a bass grumble, thick with the accents of Norvos. The prince does not wish to be disturbed. Her face had been stone before he spoke. Then it hardened. You are in my way, Hota. Obara was the eldest sand snake, a big-boned woman near to 30, with the close-set eyes and rat-brown hair of the old-town whore who'd birthed her. Beneath a mottled sand silk cloak of dun and gold, her riding clothes were old brown leather, worn and supple. They were the softest things about her. On one hip she wore a coiled whip, across her back a round shield of steel and copper. She had left her spear outside. For that, Aryo Hota gave thanks. Quick and strong as she was, the woman was no match for him, he knew. But she did not, and he had no wish to see her blood upon the pale pink marble. Master Caliot shifted his weight from foot to foot.
Lady Obara, I tried to tell you.
Does he know that my father is dead? Obara asked the captain, paying the maester no more mind than she would a fly, if any fly had been foolish enough to buzz about her head. He does, the captain said. He had a bard. Death had come to Dorne on raven wings, writ small and sealed with a blob of hard red wax. Caliot must have sensed what was in that letter, for he'd given it to Hota to deliver. The prince thanked him, but for the longest time he would not break the seal. All afternoon he'd sat with the parchment in his lap, watching the children at their play. He watched until the sun went down and the evening air grew cool enough to drive them inside. Then he watched the starlight on the water. It was moonrise before he sent Hotar to fetch a candle, so he might read his letter beneath the orange trees in the dark of night. Obara touched her whip. Thousands are crossing the sands afoot to climb the Boneway, so they may help Elaria bring my father home. The septs are packed to bursting, and the red priests have lit their temple fires. In the pillar houses, women are coupling with every man who comes to them and refusing any coin. In Sunspear, on the Broken Arm, along the Greenblood, in the mountains, out in the deep sand, everywhere, everywhere. Women tear their hair and men cry out in rage. The same question is heard on every tongue. What will Doran do? What will his brother do to avenge our murdered prince? She moved closer to the captain. And you say he does not wish to be disturbed? He does not wish to be disturbed, Ario Hotar said again. The captain of guards knew the prince he guarded. Once, long ago, a callow youth had come from Norvos, a big, broad-shouldered boy with a mop of dark hair. That hair was white now, and his body bore the scars of many battles. But his strength remained, and he kept his long axe sharp, as the bearded priests had taught him. She shall not pass, he told himself, and said, the prince is watching the children at their play. He is never to be disturbed when he is watching the children at their play. Hota, said Obara Sand, you will remove yourself from my path, else I shall take that long axe and... Captain, came the command from behind, let her pass. I will speak with her. The prince's voice was hoarse. Ario Hotar jerked his long axe upright and stepped to one side. Obara gave him a lingering last look and strode past, the maester hurrying at her heels. Caliot was no more than 5 feet tall and bald as an egg. His face was so smooth and fat that it was hard to tell his age, but he had been here before the captain, had even served the prince's mother. And despite his age and girth, he was still nimble enough and clever as they came, but meek. He is no match for any sand snake, the captain thought. In the shade of the orange trees, the prince sat in his chair with his gouty legs propped up before him and heavy bags beneath his eyes. Though whether it was grief or gout that kept him sleepless, Hotar could not say. Below in the fountains and the pools, the children were still at their play. The youngest were no more than 5, the oldest 9 and 10. Half were girls and half were boys. Hotar could hear them splashing and shouting at each other in high, shrill voices. It was not so long ago that you were one of the children in those pools, Obara, the prince said when she took one knee before his rolling chair. She snorted. It has been 20 years, or near enough, to make no matter, and I was not here long. I am the whore's whelp, or had you forgotten? When he did not answer, she rose again and put her hands upon her hips. My father has been murdered. He was slain in single combat during a trial by battle, Prince Doran said. By law, that is no murder. He was your brother. He was. What do you mean to do about his death? The prince turned his chair laboriously to face her. Though he was but 52, Doran Martell seemed much older. His body was soft and shapeless beneath his linen robes, and his legs were hard to look upon. The gout had swollen and reddened his joints grotesquely. His left knee was an apple, his right a melon, and his toes had turned to dark red grapes, so ripe it seemed as though a touch would burst them. Even the weight of a coverlet could make him shudder, though he bore the pain without complaint. Silence is a prince's friend, the captain had heard him tell his daughter once. Words are like arrows, Ariane. Once loosed, you cannot call them back. I have written to Lord Tywin. Written? If you were half the man my father was,
I am not your father. That I knew. Abara's voice was thick with contempt. You would have me go to war. I know better. You need not even leave your chair. Let me avenge my father. You have a host in the Prince's Pass. Lord Ironwood has another in the Boneway. Grant me the one and Nim the other. Let her ride the King's Road, whilst I turn the Marcher Lords out of their castles and hook round to march on Old Town. And how could you hope to hold Old Town? It will be enough to sack it. The wealth of Hightower, is it gold you want? It is blood I want. Lord Tywin shall deliver us the Mountain's Head. And who will deliver us Lord Tywin's head? The Mountain has always been his pet. The prince gestured toward the pools. Obara, look at the children, if it please you. It does not please me. I'd get more pleasure from driving my spear into Lord Tywin's belly. I'll make him sing the Rains of Castamere as I pull his bowels out and look for gold. Look, the prince repeated. I command you. A few of the older children lay face down upon the smooth pink marble, browning in the sun. Others paddled in the sea beyond. Three were building a sand castle with a great spike that resembled the spear tower of the old palace. A score or more had gathered in the big pool to watch the battles as smaller children rowed through the waist-deep shallows on the shoulders of the larger and tried to shove each other into the water. Every time a pair went down, the splash was followed by a roar of laughter. They watched a nut-brown girl yank a tow-headed boy off his brother's shoulders to tumble him head-first into the pool. "Your father played that same game once, as I did before him," said the prince. "We had 10 years between us, so I had left the pools by the time he was old enough to play. But I would watch him when I came to visit mother. He was so fierce, even as a boy, quick as a water snake. I oft saw him topple boys much bigger than himself. He reminded me of that the day he left for King's Landing. He swore that he would do it one more time, else I would never have let him go." "Let him go?" Obara laughed, "as if you could have stopped him. The Red Viper of Dawn went where he would." "He did. I wish I had some word of comfort, do. I did not come to you for comfort." Her voice was full of scorn. "The day my father came to claim me, my mother did not wish for me to go. 'She is a girl,' she said, 'and I do not think that she is yours. I had 1,000 other men.' He tossed his spear at my feet and gave my mother the back of his hand across the face, so she began to weep. 'Girl or boy, we fight our battles,' he said, 'but the gods let us choose our weapons.' He pointed to the spear, then to my mother's tears, and I picked up the spear. 'I told you she was mine,' my father said, 'and took me. My mother drank herself to death within the year. They say that she was weeping as she died.'" Obara edged closer to the prince in his chair. "Let me use the spear. I ask no more." "It is a deal to ask, Obara. I shall sleep on it. You have slept too long already. You may be right. I will send word to you at Sunspear. So long as the word is war." Obara turned upon her heel and strode off as angrily as she had come, back to the stables for a fresh horse and another headlong gallop down the road. Maester Calliot remained behind.
"My prince," the little round man asked, "do your legs hurt?"
The prince smiled faintly. "Is the sun hot?
Shall I fetch a draught for the pain?"
"No.
I need my wits about me."
The maester hesitated.
"My prince, is it prudent to allow Lady Obara to return to Sunspear? She is certain to inflame the common people. They loved your brother well."
"So did we all." He pressed his fingers to his temples. "No, you are right. I must return to Sunspear as well." The little round man hesitated.
"Is that wise?"
"Not wise, but necessary.
Best send a rider to Ricasso and have him open my apartments in the Tower of the Sun. Inform my daughter Ariane that I will be there on the morrow. My little princess. The captain had missed her sorely. You will be seen, the maester warned. The captain understood. 2 years ago, when they had left Sunspear for the peace and isolation of the water gardens, Prince Doran's gout had not been half so bad. In those days he had still walked, albeit slowly, leaning on a stick and grimacing with every step. The prince did not wish his enemies to know how feeble he had grown, and the old palace and its shadow city were full of eyes. Eyes, the captain thought, and steps he cannot climb. He would need to fly to sit atop the Tower of the Sun. I must be seen. Someone must pour oil on the waters. Dawn must be reminded that it still has a prince. He smiled wanly, old and gouty though he is. If you return to Sunspear, you will need to give audience to Princess Micella, Caliot said. Her white knight will be with her, and you know he sends letters to his queen. I suppose he does. The white knight? The captain frowned. Sir Aris had come to Dawn to attend his own princess, as Ariohotar had once come with his. Even their names sounded oddly alike, Ario and Aris. Yet there the likeness ended. The captain had left Norvos and its bearded priests, but Sir Aris Oakheart still served the Iron Throne. Hotar had felt a certain sadness whenever he saw the man in the long, snowy cloak. The times the prince had sent him down to Sunspear. One day, he sensed, the two of them would fight. On that day, Oakheart would die, with the captain's long axe crashing through his skull. He slid his hand along the smooth ashen shaft of his axe and wondered if that day was drawing nigh. The afternoon is almost done, the prince was saying. We will wait for morn. See that my litter is ready by first light. As you command. Caliot bobbed a bow. The captain stood aside to let him pass and listen to his footsteps dwindle. Captain! The prince's voice was soft. Hotar strode forward, one hand wrapped about his long axe. The ash felt as smooth as a woman's skin against his palm. When he reached the rolling chair, he thumped its butt down hard to announce his presence, but the prince had eyes only for the children. Did you have brothers, Captain? He asked, back in Norvos, when you were young, sisters? Both, Hotar said. Two brothers, three sisters. I was the youngest. The youngest and unwanted. Another mouth to feed. A big boy who ate too much and soon outgrew his clothes. Small wonder they had sold him to the bearded priests. I was the oldest, the prince said, and yet I am the last. After Mors and Oliver died in their cradles, I gave up hope of brothers. I was 9 when Elia came, a squire in service at Salt Shore. When the raven arrived with word that my mother had been brought to bed a month too soon, I was old enough to understand that meant the child would not live. Even when Lord Gargolin told me that I had a sister, I assured him that she must shortly die. Yet she lived by the mother's mercy, and a year later Oberon arrived, squalling and kicking. I was a man grown when they were playing in these pools. Yet here I sit, and they are gone. Ariohotar did not know what to say to that. He was only a captain of guards and still a stranger to this land and its seven-faced god, even after all these years. Serve, obey, protect. He had sworn those vows at 6 and 10, the day he wed his axe. Simple vows for simple men, the bearded priests had said. He had not been trained to counsel grieving princes. He was still groping for some words to say when another orange fell with a heavy splat, no more than a foot from where the prince was seated. Doran winced at the sound as if somehow it had hurt him. Enough, he sighed. It is enough. Leave me, Ario. Let me watch the children for a few more hours.
When the sun set, the air grew cool, and the children went inside in search of supper. Still, the prince remained beneath his orange trees, looking out over the still pools and the sea beyond. A serving man brought him a bowl of purple olives with flatbread cheese and chickpea paste. He ate a bit of it and drank a cup of the sweet, heavy, strong wine that he loved. When it was empty, he filled it once again. Sometimes in the deep black hours of the morning, sleep found him in his chair. Only then did the captain roll him down the moonlit gallery past a row of fluted pillars and through a graceful archway to a great bed with crisp, cool linen sheets in a chamber by the sea. Doran groaned as the captain moved him, but the gods were good, and he did not wake. The captain's sleeping cell adjoined his prince's. He sat upon the narrow bed and found his whetstone and oilcloth in their niche and set to work. "Keep your long axe sharp," the bearded priests had told him the day they branded him. He always did. As he honed the axe, Hotar thought of Norvos, the high city on the hill, and the low beside the river. He could still recall the sounds of the three bells, the way that noon's deep peals set his very bones to shuddering, the proud, strong voice of Nara, sweet Njel's silvery laughter. The taste of winter cake filled his mouth again, rich with ginger and pine nuts and bits of cherry, with Nasa to wash it down, fermented goat's milk served in an iron cup and laced with honey. He saw his mother in her dress with the squirrel collar, the one she wore but once each year when they went to see the bears dance down the sinner's steps, and he smelled the stench of burning hair as the bearded priest touched the brand to the center of his chest. The pain had been so fierce that he thought his heart might stop, yet Ariohotar had not flinched. The hair had never grown back over the axe. Only when both edges were sharp enough to shave with did the captain lay his ash and iron wife down on the bed. Yawning, he pulled off his soiled clothes, tossed them on the floor, and stretched out on his straw-stuffed mattress. Thinking of the brand had made it itch, so he had to scratch himself before he closed his eyes. "I should have gathered up the oranges that fell," he thought, and went to sleep dreaming of the tart sweet taste of them and the sticky feel of the red juice on his fingers. Dawn came too soon. Outside the stables, the smallest of the three horse litters stood ready, the cedarwood litter with the red silk draperies. The captain chose 20 spears to accompany it, out of the 30 who were posted at the water gardens. The rest would stay to guard the grounds and children, some of whom were the sons and daughters of great lords and wealthy merchants. Although the prince had spoken of departing at first light, Ariohotar knew that he would dawdle. Whilst the maester helped Doran Martell to bathe and bandaged up his swollen joints in linen wraps soaked with soothing lotions, the captain donned a shirt of copper scales, as befit his rank, and a billowing cloak of dun and yellow sand silk to keep the sun off the copper. The day promised to be hot, and the captain had long ago discarded the heavy horsehair cape and studded leather tunic he had worn in Norvos, which were like to cook a man in dawn. He had kept his iron half-helm with its crest of sharpened spikes, but now he wore it wrapped in orange silk, weaving the cloth in and around the spikes. Elsewise, the sun beating down on the metal would have his head pounding before they saw the palace. The prince was still not ready to depart. He had decided to break his fast before he went, with a blood orange and a plate of gull's eggs, diced with bits of ham and fiery peppers. Then naught would do, but he must say farewell to several of the children who had become especial favourites, the Dalt boy and Lady Blackmont's brood and the round-faced orphan girl, whose father sold cloth and spices up and down the green blood. Doran kept a splendid mirish blanket over his legs as he spoke with them, to spare the young ones the sight of his swollen, bandaged joints. It was midday before they got underway, the prince in his litter, Maester Calliot riding on a donkey, the rest afoot. 5 spearmen walked ahead and 5 behind, with 5 more flanking the litter to either side. Ariohotar himself took his familiar place at the left hand of the prince, resting his long axe on a shoulder as he walked. The road from Sunspear to the water gardens ran beside the sea, so they had a cool, fresh breeze to soothe them as they made their way across a sparse red-brown land of stone and sand and twisted, stunted trees. Halfway there, the second sand snake caught them. She appeared suddenly upon a dune, mounted on a golden sand steed, with a mane like fine white silk. Even a horse, the Lady Nim, looked graceful, dressed all in shimmering lilac robes, and a great silk cape of cream and copper that lifted at every gust of wind, and made her look as if she might take flight. Nymeria Sand was 25 and slender as a willow. Her straight black hair, worn in a long braid, bound up with red-gold wire, made a widow's peak above her dark eyes, just as her father's had. With her high cheekbones, full lips, and milk-pale skin, she had all the beauty that her elder sister lacked. But Obara's mother had been an old town whore, whilst Nim was born from the noblest blood of old Volantis. A dozen mounted spearmen tailed her, their round shields gleaming in the sun. They followed her down the dune. The prince had tied back the curtains on his litter, the better to enjoy the breeze blowing off the sea. Lady Nim fell in beside him, slowing her pretty golden mare to match the litter's pace. "Well met, uncle," she sang out, as if it had been chance that brought her here. "May I ride with you to Sunspear?" The captain was on the opposite side of the litter from Lady Nim, yet he could hear every word she said. "I would be glad of it," Prince Doran replied, though he did not sound glad to the captain's ears. "Gout and grief make poor companions on the road," by which the captain knew him to mean that every pebble drove a spike through his swollen joints. "The gout I cannot help," she said, "but my father had no use for grief. Vengeance was more to his taste. Is it true that Gregor Clegane admitted slaying Elia and her children?" "He roared out his guilt for all the court to hear," the prince admitted. "Lord Tywin has promised us his head." "And a Lannister always pays his debts," said Lady Nim. "Yet it seems to me that Lord Tywin means to pay us with our own coin. I had a bird from our sweet Sir Damon, who swears my father tickled that monster more than once as they fought. If so, Sir Gregor is as good as dead, and no thanks to Tywin Lannister." The prince grimaced. Whether it was from pain of gout or his niece's words, the captain could not say. "It may be so." "May be? I say 'tis. Obara would have me go to war." Nim laughed. "Yes, she wants to set the torch to Old Town. She hates that city as much as our little sister loves it." "And you?" Nim glanced over her shoulder to where her companions rode a dozen lengths behind. "I was abed with the Fowler twins when the word reached me," the captain heard her say. "You know the Fowler words? Let me soar. That's all I ask of you. Let me soar, uncle. I need no mighty host, only one sweet sister." "Obara? Tyene. Obara is too loud. Tyene is so sweet and gentle that no man will suspect her. Obara would make Old Town our father's funeral pyre, but I am not so greedy. 4 lives will suffice for me. Lord Tywin's golden twins as payment for Elia's children, the old lion for Elia herself, and last of all, the little king for my father. The boy has never wronged us. The boy is a bastard born of treason, incest, and adultery, if Lord Stannis can be believed." The playful tone had vanished from her voice, and the captain found himself watching her through narrowed eyes. Her sister Obara wore her whip upon her hip and carried a spear where any man could see it. Lady Nim was no less deadly, though she kept her knives well hidden. "Only royal blood can wash out my father's murder. Oberyn died during single combat, fighting in a matter that was none of his concern. I do not call that murder." "Call it what you will. We sent them the finest man in Dorne, and they are sending back a bag of bones. He went beyond anything I asked of him. Take the measure of this boy king and his council, and make note of their strengths and weaknesses," I told him on the terrace. We were eating oranges
Find us friends, if there are any to be found. Learn what you can of Ilya's end, but see that you do not provoke Lord Tywin unduly. Those were my words to him. Oberyn laughed and said, "When have I provoked any man unduly? You would do better to warn the Lannisters against provoking me." He wanted justice for Ilya, but he would not wait. He waited 10 and 7 years. The Lady Nym broke in. Were it you they'd killed? My father would have led his banners north before your corpse was cold. Were it you, the spears would be falling thick as rain upon the marches now. I do not doubt it. No more should you doubt this, my prince. My sisters and I shall not wait 10 and 7 years for our vengeance. She put her spurs into the mare, and she was off, galloping towards Sunspear with her tail in hot pursuit. The prince leaned back against his pillows and closed his eyes, but Hotar knew he did not sleep. He is in pain. For a moment he considered calling Maester Calliot up to the litter, but if Prince Doran had wanted him, he would have called himself. The shadows of the afternoon were long and dark, and the sun was as red and swollen as the prince's joints before they glimpsed the towers of Sunspear to the east. First, the slender spear tower, 100.5 feet tall and crowned with a spear of gilded steel that added another 30 feet to its height. Then the mighty Tower of the Sun with its dome of gold and leaded glass. Last, the dun-coloured sand ship, looking like some monstrous dromond that had washed ashore and turned to stone. Only 3 leagues of coast road divided Sunspear from the water gardens, yet they were 2 different worlds. There, children frolicked naked in the sun, music played in tiled courtyards, and the air was sharp with the smell of lemons and blood oranges. Here, the air smelled of dust, sweat, and smoke, and the nights were alive with the babble of voices. In place of the pink marble of the water gardens, Sunspear was built from mud and straw, and coloured brown and dun. The ancient stronghold of House Martell stood at the easternmost end of a little jut of stone and sand, surrounded on 3 sides by the sea. To the west, in the shadows of Sunspear's massive walls, mud-brick shops and windowless hovels clung to the castle like barnacles to a galley's hull. Stables and inns and wine-sinks and pillow-houses had grown up west of those, many enclosed by walls of their own, and yet more hovels had risen beneath those walls. And so, and so, and so, as the bearded priests would say. Compared to Tyrosh or Myr or Great Norvos, the Shadow City was no more than a town, yet it was the nearest thing to a true city that these Dornish had. Lady Nym's arrival had preceded theirs by some hours, and no doubt she had warned the guards of their coming, for the threefold gate was open when they reached it. Only here were the gates lined up one behind the other to allow visitors to pass beneath all 3 of the winding walls directly to the old palace, without first making their way through miles of narrow alleys, hidden courts, and noisy bazaars. Prince Doran had closed the draperies of his litter as soon as the spear tower came in sight, yet still the small folk shouted out to him as the litter passed. "The sand snakes have stirred them to a boil," the captain thought uneasily. They crossed the squalor of the outer crescent and went through the second gate. Beyond, the wind stank of tar and salt water and rotting seaweed, and the crowd grew thicker with every step. "Make way for Prince Doran!" Ario Hotar boomed out, thumping the butt of his long axe on the bricks. "Make way for the Prince of Dorne!"
"The prince is dead!"
a woman shrilled behind him. "To spears!" a man bellowed from a balcony.
"Doran!"
called some high-born voice.
"To the spears!"
Hotar gave up looking for the speakers. The press was too thick, and 1/3 of them were shouting. "To spears! Vengeance for the viper!" By the time they reached the 3rd gate, the guards were shoving people aside to clear a path for the prince's litter, and the crowd was throwing things. One ragged boy darted past the spearmen with a half-rotten pomegranate in one hand, but when he saw Ario Hotar in his path, with long axe at the ready, he let the fruit fall, unthrown, and beat a quick retreat.
Others farther back let fly with lemons, limes, and oranges, crying, "War! War! To the spears!" One of the guards was hit in the eye with a